This morning we'll be looking at part two in our series on church leadership. You remember last Sunday we looked at verses 5 and 6 and saw how the Apostle Paul had given Titus very clear instruction about setting the church or the churches on the Isle of Crete back in order. And that process was going to start by appointing elders in every city. Paul then goes on to tell Titus about the qualifications that are required of these men. These men are to have a great moral character and are to be committed to true doctrine, just as Paul himself was. I mean, Paul opens this letter telling about that commitment. He says in verse 1, Paul, a bondservant of God, an apostle of Jesus Christ, according to the faith of God's elect, and the acknowledgement of the truth which accords with godliness. You see, there's a direct connection between knowing the truth and walking in godliness. Now, in the postmodern time, there seems to be attempts to try to blur that line between what the Spirit of God has proclaimed to be true and what the world accepts as truth. Just as in Paul's day, there's a direct assault on the gates of heaven. And it's by nothing other than moral and doctrinal relativism. This has entered church through the gate of cultural relevance. You hear that all the time. How is this relevant to me? As if God needs to be relevant to his creation. We need to be relevant to him. He created us. And so it's where we see that people will sit there and go, I want to make a God that's relevant for me in this time. And one of the ways that that is done is by looking at doctrinal purity as a secondary thing that we have to worry about. And also looking to see how many people can we get to follow us. Because in the number of people that follow shows truth to the world. I mean, you heard about jumping on the bandwagon? Well, people jump on the bandwagon because everyone else is doing it. And that's no different within the church, or the visible church at least. You know, it's as if the purpose of evangelism is to gather in one place people that are doctrinally diverse and they have highly personalized opinions on the nature of God. So that they go, well, to me, this is God. And someone else says, yeah, but to me, he's this. And so people will sit there and have a subjective view of who God is. And so because of that, they have a subjective view of what a good moral person looks like too. They go, well, the person seems to be of good character. And I mean, even if he does things that aren't good, he's still one of the good old boys. Never meaning no harm. Yeah, I think we know where that comes from. But, you know, we don't have a Dukes of Hazzard church. We have a church that is founded on truth. And yet, there's so much mystery and imagination that gets put on par with the revealed truth of the Word of God. So that, you know, if there's I think this is what a good person looks like. And they say, how is that actually acted out in their lives? Or does their life have any influence on that? A lot of people would say no. If you say you're good and you don't do anything really bad, that's good enough for them. So they have tried to personalize their walk with God by saying, this is what I'm willing to do, and at least I haven't done this or that. I'm a good person, therefore. The world accepts that. But that's nothing new. Paul saw that in his day. And so he gives implicit instructions to Titus. Here's exactly, no gray areas, here's exactly what I want you to see in church leadership. Now, church leadership is very complex and demanding. It's very, very hard work, and it takes sacrifice. You know, church leadership is not meant to be glamorous, and it's not meant to be a mantle of status to where you go, well, I'm the pastor of the church, or I'm the chairman of the elder board, as if that's something great. You know, church leadership should not come to men just because they have money or they give a lot to the church. It shouldn't be because of family connections where, well, you know, my dad used to pastor a church down the road, and therefore that somehow qualifies me to be part of this church as a leader. It shouldn't be based on intelligence or education or even human talent. What Paul says is the requirements are faultless character, spiritual maturity, a willingness to serve humbly. But there does need to be one skill, and that is to be able to teach and preach. Now, the people that are chosen for this, they might be rich, they might be poor, they might be unknown, or they might be well known. It might be people who have failed at some sort of enterprise in life. Or it might have been someone who did well, had a measure of success. It really doesn't have anything to do with any of that. What it has to do with is being a godly man of godly character. Therefore, the biblical church government is one that allows Jesus Christ, and I'm saying allows, not that he needs us to allow him. I'm saying allow in our own attitudes toward him to function as the living head of his body. He is the head of the church, period. We don't allow him to be the head. What we do is allow our attitudes to understand that he is the head of the church. And that what we need to do is understand that our wills need to be convinced that we need to look at his will. We need to have our will in subject to his will. And so when we go and we fight for something, we shouldn't fight for just anything. We shouldn't fight for things that don't matter. We should fight for the things that are in line with the will of God. You see that? We need to make sure that we go, I'm going to take up this cause. What does the Word of God say about this? And seek and study and pray to know that what you're doing is in line with God's will. And you know, the church isn't run by just one man. It's run through a plurality of godly men under the headship of Christ. Now, the situation behind the text that we see here today is that the Apostle Paul has left Titus in Crete. And it says, in order to what is lacking in the church, to appoint elders in every city. Now, he's saying we need to set in order things. That setting in order is the same thing, or the same thought of setting broken bones. When a bone is broken, you set the bone. You put it in right alignment with the other part of the bone. That's basically what is happening here. And so Paul is entrusting Titus this momentous task of setting this church back in order. And John Calvin writes that this actually reveals Paul's humility. And it reveals his humility because he's saying, you know what? I might have started all of this. I might have gotten it together. But let me tell you one thing. I'm not in it for my glory. I'm willing to pass it off onto you that you can take it to fruition. I'm not going, hey, I need my name stamped on this church. So you have John Calvin says, that's actually showing humility on the part of Paul. And so Paul is saying, here, Titus, here are some things that I want you to make sure you do. You need to look at the qualifications for these elders that you are going to set in place. They need godly, mature, moral leaders that can stand firm on the truth of God and then refute any error that comes along. So let's go ahead and look at our text for this morning. It's Titus chapter 1 and verses 5 through 9. It says, for this reason I left you in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are lacking, and appoint elders in every city as I commanded you. If a man is blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination. For a bishop must be blameless, a steward of God, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but hospitable, a lover of what is good, sober-minded, just, holy, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able, by sound doctrine, both to exhort and convict those who contradict. So this morning, we're going to try to tackle verses 7 and 8. And what you'll notice immediately in verse 7 is that it starts off with a phrase that is very similar to verse 6. If a man is blameless, it says in verse 6. Well, then in verse 7 it says, for a bishop must be blameless. Now, verse 6 is talking about, you know, as you're looking, you know, if a man is blameless, you're looking at, you know, you have all these men. If a man is blameless, you're looking for that kind of guy. But then verse 7 says that this is a requirement for the one that is chosen. Now, I mentioned last week that the term bishop, pastor, elder, overseer, they're all interchangeable terms. But all each one does describe an aspect of the position. The term elder tends to speak of a person who has a kind of maturity that comes with age. And it doesn't mean that you have to be old. I mean, our brother Tim, he's not really all that old. But what it does mean is that he has a maturity beyond his years. He is a mature man. And, you know, then you see overseer, bishop. That sort of speaks of the function of leadership. And then the word pastor speaks of the function of feeding the sheep. But when it comes right down to it, elders are overseers who shepherd. Elders are overseers who shepherd. You get all of them all in one. That's the nuts and bolts of church leadership. And we can see these interchangeable words in 1 Peter chapter 5. And we'll look at verses 1 through 4. So if you turn there, 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. Now, starting with verse 1, it says, the elders who are among you, I exhort. I am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. Here we see another term, shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as, here's another word, overseers, not by compulsion but willingly, not for dishonest gain but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. When the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. Elders are mature men who feed and lead the flock. They aren't men of just great virtue, so that they have a personal virtue of personal holiness. They are men that are chosen so that they can establish a pattern for others to follow. And so, in verse 7 of our text, the first word that we see is blameless again. And the word is anankletos. Anankletos, which means unaccusable, unreproachable, one that cannot be called into account. Now again, this does not mean sinless. We will never be sinless in this lifetime. It means blameless. It means that no one can sit there and look and say, I'm going to accuse that person because I see them doing it all the time. But here in verse 6, if you look back, it says that if he is blameless, again, it's looking at the person who you'd look to fulfill the office. But then in verse 7, it says that you must be blameless. It implies not merely acquittal, but the absence of even a charge or accusation against that person. Now, the word here that we see is the word day, D-I-E. And it means it's a necessity to have, a commandment to have. A requirement within this position is to be blameless. It's not optional, and it's non-negotiable. Not for any church. The problem is, sometimes you see big churches that will go, okay, we have enough people, we'll find these blameless, godly men. And then little churches, well, you got to work with what you got. Warren Wiersbe says, the fact that these standards apply to Christians on the Isle of Crete, as well as those in the city of Ephesus, prove that God's measure for leaders does not fluctuate. A big city church and a small town church both need godly people in places of leadership, end quote. And so you don't sit there and go, well, we're a small church, we're going to appoint these men that do not meet these qualifications. You can't do that. But then continuing in verse 7, our text says, as a steward of God. This is important. This is very important. The word steward in the Greek is oikonomos. Oikonomos. And it's actually a compound word. It uses the word house, oikos, and it uses the term law, which is nomos. So you have the law of the house. The person must be of the law of the house. He must know how to fulfill that. He doesn't own it. He's a steward of it. By the way, this is where we get our word economy from. He needs to know how to put it all together, to run faithfully the household as a manager, managing all the people and the resources. He needs to know how to get the work done. He needs to know how to plant the crops and then gather them in and then get all the food. He needs to make sure all the workers are fed and that they're assigned all the right tasks according to their abilities. He works out the daily schedules. He also is the one who is responsible for correction and discipline among the workers, the helpers. But he also is the one who trains them. He trains them as needed. He's the one who takes care of the wounded and the ill. He manages the household. He is a steward of that. In 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4, Paul tells Timothy, an elder is a man who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. And then it continues in verse 5, for if a man does not know how to rule his own house, who will take care of the house of, or who will take care of the church of God, the household of God? If he cannot even exercise good stewardship in what he owns, in his own house where he has personal interest, vested interest in it, how in the world is he going to do that when he is given charge of something he doesn't own? How is he going to do that? The elder needs to be the overseer of God's household. And as Mark read this morning in Hebrews 13, verse 17, it says, obey those who rule over you. Now, those are the elders. Obey the elders and be submissive. Here's what they watch over also. For they watch out for your souls and must give account. You realize that? The elders watch out for your very souls and must give an account to God for them. It says, therefore, let them do so with joy and not grief, for that would be unprofitable to you. The elder should not be grieved watching out for your very souls. He should be able to do it with joy. And now continuing in verse 7 of our text, we'll see that it starts to give this list. In verse 7, it starts off with a negative list, negative character traits. And then in verse 8, starts with positive character traits. There's 5 negatives and 6 positives. And basically, the ones listed in verse 7 should not be present in an elder or pastor, and then the ones in verse 8 should be, and it should be in good measure. So, starting with the negative or disqualifying ones, in verse 7, it says, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money. So we'll start with the first one, not self-willed. And this is a very interesting word because it's a very strong word. It's the word anai. Anai. And it literally means consumed with yourself, seeking your own way for your own satisfaction and your own gratification. It's to the disregard of other people. It's someone who is headstrong and self-seeking. Now, false teachers tend to fall in this category. Those false teachers, they are wolves in sheep's clothing. They are all about the wolf. They're not about the sheep. And they fall in this category. In 2 Peter 2:10, it says that false teachers are presumptuous and self-willed. And sometimes they are just so arrogant that they don't even tremble when they are up against angelic majesties. They don't have any sense to realize who they're dealing with, especially when they're dealing with the kingdom of darkness. They have no idea. They are so egotistical and arrogant that they are not going to let anything or anyone stand in their way. And they have no regard for authority or any regard for power from anyone else. It's all about them. And so an elder is not to do these things according to his own will. He is to seek out the will of God for the glory of God. He isn't to be bullheaded or stubborn on things that are insignificant. But listen here. Listen to this. He is to be that with regard to the truth. The truth of Christ. Right there, he should be uncompromising and single-minded. He needs to be firm but gentle. Now, if you remember what we read in 1 Peter chapter 5, shepherds of the flock of God, which is among you, serving as overseers, are not to do it by compulsion, but willingly. Not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. Not being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples of the flock, for the flock. The elder is supposed to be an example. And the elder needs to always be examining his heart all the time. But there's a catch-22 here. And I think it's interesting. John MacArthur was asked by a young student, how do you know when you're humble? And MacArthur says, well, at the point you think you are, you're not. So if you think you're humble, you're really not. You see, this is a lifelong fight. This is a lifelong process where you never think that you have achieved it, but you're always fighting that fight to achieve it. Does that make sense? That you are always fighting your own will, your own fleshly desires, your own self-gratification and self-glory. And as long as you're in the fight, you're all right. As long as you think that you have won, you're done. You see, you never get there. You might have small victories in the battles, but you will never win the war. It's always something that you are pursuing, humility. The next thing that we see on the list in verse 7 is not quick-tempered. Not quick-tempered. And this word is only used here in this text. And it's the word orgelos. Orgelos. Now, equivalents of this word are found throughout Scripture, like the word orge. Orge. That is the word wrath. Now, I've got to mention, you know, it says, not quick-tempered. It doesn't mean the guy who just at one point loses it. At one point gets really upset about something. Because that's going to happen. That's going to happen in everyone's lifetime. That someone just loses it. But to what extent, there's an issue there also. But to get very upset. This is someone who is quick-tempered. It's not talking about the person who just got angry at something. This is someone who you always think that there's a fuse underneath the surface. That you think that there's always something that you might say that'll set this person off. And you've seen it enough to where you always measure your words so carefully not to hit that fuse. That's a person who is quick-tempered. He's just one spark away from blowing up. And he uses that. You know, you would think that a quick-tempered person would hide it. But this person uses it to their advantage. They intimidate and control by it. They want everyone to know. Because then people are going to be really set back. And he will gain control. James 1, 19 and 20 commands, "But let everyone be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. For the anger of a man does not achieve the righteousness of God." We need to keep that in perspective. That anger is not the way to deal with things. And so now moving on in verse 7 of our text, it says the characteristic of not given to wine. Now, this word in the Greek is very very peculiar. It's the word paroinos. It's also a compound word. It uses the word para, which means to come alongside, and oinos, which is wine. Have you gathered what it means? To come alongside wine. It means that you always have maybe a drink in your hand. You are always known to have wine or, you know, a drink. And so it says that an elder must not be a man who is given to too much wine. He cannot be a man who is addicted to the excess. Now, this does not prohibit the use of wine or alcoholic beverages. What it does is prohibits the abuse of these things. As a matter of fact, Paul encouraged Timothy to have a little wine. In 1 Timothy 5:23, Paul says, "No longer drink only water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and your frequent infirmities." And so here we see that wine is, a little bit of wine is good for the infirmities. But it needs to be in great moderation. It is not to be drunken with wine. To be drunk is flat out sin. In Titus chapter 2, I want to just take a look at Titus chapter 2, verse 3. Here is very interesting. And obviously we're going through Titus, so we'll get to this. But here it says, "The older women likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanders, not given to too much wine." And so, you older women, watch how many times you pull the cork out of the vino. That's not good. That same instruction is given about deacons in 1 Timothy. Do you see a pattern here? A pattern is that, yeah, it's not only for leadership, it's talking about everyone in the congregation. Those who want to come alongside the wine. You know, the point is that all believers should be clear-headed and avoid anything that dulls the clarity of the mind. This must be a display of leadership. They should be someone who is not given to wine. Let me give an example. Let's say there's a doctor who's on call, right? He's on call. He's pulling the cork. And you get in an accident. You end up at the emergency room. He's called. How would you feel? I'm not talking about if the guy is just drunk, slobbering. I'm talking about where he has had enough, so his thinking might not be as clear. Sort of scary, isn't it? You getting the point? As soon as you have enough to make a change in your thought process, it's probably going toward having too much. You are to be clear-minded. You know, a lot of people who are drunks, the first couple beers or whatever, they're just happy as can be. And then they get to a point where they're just mean, nasty drunks. You see, it's the first couple that changes the person's character, changes their attitude. They're sort of like nothing till they get those first couple in them. Then they're cheerful. You see, there's a change. There's enough to go from clear-minded to not clear-minded. That's what it's talking about. And so here we're talking about church leadership. We need to be careful. Church leaders need to especially be careful that they don't sit there and involve themselves in this and cause someone else to stumble. If there's a young man or a young lady in the congregation who sees, who knows, who goes, oh yeah, you know, Brendan does it, Tim does it, and they go, I can do it too, and causes them to revert back to their addiction. We have responsibility in that. And so we need to think about that carefully. And so many elders will say, I'm not going to drink at all because I want to keep in mind my position and the example that I set. So the next thing that we see is not violent. And this is interesting because it means one who punches you. You know, not violent. The old lexicon says, a giver of blows. Yeah. It's talking about someone who uses his hand, his fist, a stick, a rock to hit you. They're a giver of blows. And this can be something that's physical or verbal. A verbal blow. An elder, on the other hand, must be gentle and a peacemaker. Shouldn't be a contentious brawler. He needs to be a spiritual leader who is looking to resolve conflict in a peaceable manner, in a biblical manner, in a godly, gentle manner. That's what an elder is. That's what a pastor is. The next one on our list is not greedy for money. The King James Version says, not given to filthy lucre. The Greek word is askrakardes, which is a compound word again. You know, I like how the Greeks were good at putting these words together. And the two words mean shameful and gain. So it's saying that someone should not be going after shameful gain. Someone who doesn't care how he makes his money. He just wants to make it. He doesn't have integrity on how he earns his living. A lot of TV evangelists can fall into this where they make millions of dollars off of people all in the name of Jesus Christ. I just read, there's a list on the internet, the 10 most highly paid pastors. And of course, you have the Joel Osteens, where I think it was $40 million for him. And he says, well, I don't take a wage from the church at all. I work for free. I get the $40 million off of my book sales. Let me hold this in contrast to John MacArthur, who says, I will take a wage from the church, but all my book sales, I give. I give all the profits. So instead of making $40 million on book sales and maybe $100,000 from the church, MacArthur goes, I'll make the $80 or $100 or whatever he makes, and I'll give the $40 million away. See the difference? And then, believe it or not, there's a pastor in this country, Stuart Copeland, makes almost $1 billion per year off the ministry. $1 billion. No one was even close on that list. Not even close. But you know what? In this, I want you to know that it is not wrong for a person to be paid in the ministry. Turn, if you would, turn to 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verses 17 and 18. First Timothy chapter 5, starting with verse 17, it says, "Let the elders who rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in the word and doctrine." Now that's an important part right there. "For the scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. And the laborer is worthy of his wages." You see, if you look at that, one who labors in the word and doctrine. And then it says the laborer. Normally, it's the pastor who receives a wage for his work. But he isn't in it for the money. He doesn't do it because he wants money. Where on the other hand, false teachers do. That's what they want. They see it as a good way to make a lot of money. Money itself is not evil, but it can be dangerous. It's like a loaded gun. It can be used usefully if properly used, but it can also hurt you or others if it's used carelessly. And so a greedy man is not qualified to be an elder. Greedy men are not godly men. And so let's go on to the next verse, and it talks about positive qualities of an elder. Positive qualities must be hospitable. This is talking about the pastor and elder. They must be hospitable. And the Greek word is philoxenos. Philoxenos. And there again we have a compound word. It comes from the Greek word phileo, which is love, and xenos, which is strangers. So it literally reads a love for strangers. Hebrews 13, 1 and 2 says, "Let brotherly love continue. Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by doing so you may have unwittingly entertained angels." Now, I do believe that right there it's talking about angels. But the word that's used is sometimes means messenger from God. So we entertain strangers, who, especially those who are in the household of faith. And we use it as a way to convey blessing. And so hospitality, as it's used here, really isn't talking about friends. It's not saying, "Hey, let's have friends over." That's not hospitable in the biblical sense. It's great to do that. But if you want to see how it should be used, look at Luke chapter 14. So if you turn to Luke chapter 14 and verses 12 through 14. Luke chapter 14. No, this is Jesus talking. And when he's talking to his disciples, and he says in verse 12 here, "Then he said, also said to him who invited him, 'When you give a dinner or a supper, do not ask your friends, your brothers, your relatives, nor rich neighbors, lest they also invite you back and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, And you will be blessed because they cannot repay you. For you shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just. You see, it's talking about loving strangers, opening your resources to strangers. This is the kind of man you're looking for leadership. He's willing to do things for others that he doesn't even know. Now, in verse 8, the next thing is, it says that he should, an elder should be a lover of what is good. Again, a compound word. Philagathos. And again, the first part is phileo, meaning love. And agathos, which is good. He loves good men. He's a lover of those who are like-minded, who are good, of good character. You see all these people that like to gather around people who are exactly opposite and rude, and they just sit there and sort of have fun watching these men of poor character around them, because they sort of live out vicariously through these people. This is talking about a person who loves to have good-charactered people around him. He loves to see the good things that others are doing. He loves to see what a man is all about, and that a man is, has set his mind on things of God. And we see the best description of this in Philippians chapter 4 and verses 8 and 9. So if you'd please turn to Philippians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. Starting with verse 8, Philippians chapter 4. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are good, of good report, if there is any virtue, and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you. That is what it means, that this man loves those things that are true, honorable, right, pure, lovely, of good report, the excellent things of God. That's the mark of a man that should be in leadership, or that can be in leadership. He loves what is good. He's devoted to what is right. He doesn't praise people just to get, he was praising so-and-so, even though the man is of poor character. He doesn't do it just so that people will be impressed. He puts his heart toward it and says, I will praise people who are praiseworthy. The next thing is sober-minded. The word is sophron. And it comes from two words, sophrome and sozo. And it means, sozo means to save. Sophrome means mind. He is a man of saving thoughts. He is right-minded. In other words, he controls his mind. He controls his thoughts. He's not a man who is looking to always clown around. Doesn't mean that he can't have a sense of humor, but he is just as willing. Well, actually, he's more than just willing. He is more than willing. He would rather talk about the wise, deep, profound things of God than to be goofy. The same word is translated prudent. It means that he has a form of wisdom in his thinking process. And then the next thing that we have on the list is just. And the Greek word is dikaios. And it means a conduct that meets God's standards. It's the New Testament word for righteous. It's a legal term indicating a divine verdict on his life is positive. God approves this man. The next word that we see is holy. And the word there is hosios. It means pure, unpolluted, free from the stain of sin. Again, it takes us back to above reproach, that he's blameless. His life is exemplary. He's watching what he does. He's concerned about what he does. And finally, we get to the end of the list, and the word here is self-control. The Greek word is enkrates. Enkrates. And it means, literally, restrained. He has control of his life. The thing that you see of this man is he is the same in front of people as he is at home. There's no difference. He controls his life. He's not one of those phony Christians, a pretend Christian. He is a man that is devoted soberly to his Christian life, to the Word of God. He knows that the world is watching, and he is concerned about that. He lives his life as if the world is focused in on him. Those outside the church are not likely to bring charge against him. They may, but it won't be because of immorality. It'll more be they don't agree with him on something. This man doesn't need to be watched. He's not sitting there going, I'll only be good when people see what I'm doing. He'll do what is right because his mind is set on that. And sadly, there are people in the pulpits around this country that are wicked and unprincipled. They find the pulpit as a place to hide out. They don't sit there and worry. They don't even really study for a sermon. They sit there, and sometimes, I was at a church once where this guy, you could tell, all he did was probably 9 o'clock at Sunday or a Saturday evening, probably thought, oh man, I don't have anything ready for tomorrow, and came up with something. And you could tell sitting there that this man just came up with something at the end of the day just to have something to say. No kind of study, didn't get deep into anything. It was all shallow. It was all, you know, just all these different jokes and stories and stuff. That's not what the pulpit needs. Pulpit needs a person who is willing to get in there, who is willing to put the effort and time into study so that he can preach the truth and stay with the truth. And the thing about this is the self-control and kratos. It's the last word in Galatians 5, 22 and 23. Does that ring a bell what that is? That's a list of the fruit of the Spirit. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control. Against there is no law. Paul is obviously commanding Titus that you need to choose men from among the church. You need to choose men of great moral character. And these men shouldn't be hired guns that sort of go into this church and they help build it up and then they move on to bigger and better things. Maybe they get a job somewhere within a bigger church. The position of elder is an important position, and it should always be taken very seriously when appointing a man to the position. Now that's all the farther that we're going to get this morning. Next Lord's Day, God willing, we'll look at a more theological qualification for the position of elder as we look at verse 9 that says, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and convict those who contradict. And I wasn't planning on having a three-part series here, but I think that's exactly what we're heading toward, is having a three-part series, because this is much too important to rush through. And so next Lord's Day, God willing, we'll hear the theological qualifications of an elder. So if you would